The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Annika Gall, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from Vogue magazine. Well, welcome back, everyone. Today is the 25th of July. Still in the thick of summer, as we can tell by the heat. But anyway, I am so glad that we are back together, and I hope that you've been enjoying your summer. I have a wonderful story about ice cream coming up. And in fact, you know what? We might just start off with that ice cream story. The ice cream's cometh. All right. Isn't that what the kids say these days? It should be. The phrase is ana uhib anta tuhib. Nachnu jamai an nuhib al buza. The phrase is Arabic for I scream, you scream, we all scream for buza. Buza is a Middle Eastern ice cream made with ground orchid root and tree resin. And before I go on about it, which I could for a while, I'd like to point out that buza is just one of a breathtaking variety of iced desserts on offer this summer. Whatever nators of democracy we've reached, we have ascended in a pinnacle of frozen treats. Ours is a sweetened and chilled golden age. It is an ice cream belle époque. Here is kakigori, a feather-light pile of Japanese shaved ice doused in emerald green matcha syrup. There are Mexican paletas, ice pops, in tantalizing flavors like cinnamon with goat milk caramel or mango and chili, and pints of creamy green cado, an Iowa-made avocado-based concoction in seven different flavors. Why not sample whipped acai or acai from California? A spoonful of Italian gelato swirled with tangy cheese, or something delicious and vegan with a coconut base or almond or cashew, delicately flavored with black sesame. For far too long, we have limited ourselves out of some perverse culinary myopia to churned dairy products made of at least 10% milk fat, less than 1.4% egg yolk, and weighing at least 4.5 pounds per gallon. That is an abbreviation of the FDA definition of ice cream, which is 2,408 words long and makes the tax code read like Pat the Bunny. How naive we were. For the record, what we think of as American ice cream actually originated in Italy in the 17th century and was typically eggless. Maybe this is why gelato has been embraced here since the 1980s. Our horizons are finally expanding. A worldliness has taken hold, the same one that landed ramen and poke in the mainstream, along with a coinciding openness to plant milks and plant-based foods in general. What sentient oat milk-loving cosmopolitan wouldn't have heard her interest piqued by a scoop of tahini-flavored Indian kulfi? You'd have to be from the 17th century. Are any of them any good? I'm glad you asked. In the interest of finding out, on the first warm day of spring, I drove to the nearest largest Whole Foods and bought every non-dairy ice cream I could find. There was an entire case devoted to that category. And logged on to the website Gold Belly, which ships specialty foods to order vegan ice cream in Asian-inspired flavors from a New York-based company called Nuna, N-O-O-N-A, 4 pints from New York's Tipsy Scoop, in fascinating flavors like cake batter vodka martini, I've never tasted a cake batter vodka martini, and a case of Indian-influenced ice cream called Malai from Brooklyn, in cinnamon almond, masala chai, and sweet milk. Portland's ice cream emporium, Salt and Straw, has a whole non-dairy line, which they shipped direct, as did the Oregon company, So. Delicious, which makes cashew milk, oat milk, coconut milk, almond milk, and soy milk based frozen desserts. A case of Booza from Republic of Booza in Brooklyn, and some Coconut Bliss flavor, Infinite Coconut, bought at my favorite local supermarket, rounded out my selection. The total pint count was something close to 50. The counting was done by a 7-year-old. It is my opinion that she was distracted and may have double counted or made omissions. On a balmy Sunday evening, after a modest meal of 8 pizzas, a small group, including the 7-year-old, her 11-year-old brother, my son, 2, and his cousin, 3, plus 2 adult ice cream aficionados born and raised in close range of the Ben & Jerry's factory in Vermont, one writer who is a known contrarian, and sundry other grown-ups gathered in my kitchen. I had designed my tasting with care and discretion. A pretty cream-colored flower pot full of spoons was arranged at the end of a long wooden kitchen counter, and a pad of paper for ratings and reactions at the other. It would be simple to collect responses and draw a matrix of qualities and preferences. But faced with 50 pints of ice cream, human beings go crazy. There was a stampede. My son absconded with a pint of vegan pistachio from New York's Van Leeuwen, which predicted this whole trend with its artisanal ice cream served out of a buttercup yellow truck back in 2008. I lost my notebook. Its pages, I believe, were used as napkins. Eventually, an adult turned on the water tap and insisted that everyone eating directly from a pint rinse his or her spoon and then move on. This order imposed, some opinions emerged, which I report from memory. Many of the plant-based ice creams were found too icy. This iciness, some complained, exaggerated flavor. The richest non-dairy candidates were made with coconut milk. The issue with coconut ice cream, though, is that its flavor is so strong that all varieties taste like coconut hyphenates. The contrarian declared an adamant objection to the entire category of non-dairy ice creams. "Just don't call them ice cream," he shouted, feeling, I think, as though language and tradition themselves were under attack. Technically, he is correct. According to the FDA, there should be no such thing as non-dairy ice cream. Why the FDA won't admit that the definition of ice cream expanded de facto in 2012, when a technique for blending frozen bananas into ice cream swept the internet? I don't know. I assume it's the dairy lobby, which is still working on legislation to limit the definition of milk to the product of lactating ruminants. As someone with great emotional affection for lactose but no physical tolerance for it, I am blessed with the ability to taste through nostalgia and FDA parochialism. Kato Mint Chocolate Chip is as creamy and minty as anything should be. I love Nadamu's coconut-based maple pecan. But then I adore coconut so entirely that my mouth starts watering when I'm around people tanning. All the Van Leeuwen vegan flavors, coconut hyphenates, though they may be, were near perfect. Coconut Bliss is the most honest coconut ice cream on the market. Its ingredients are organic coconut milk, organic agave syrup, organic coconut cream, organic dried coconut, organic coconut extract, organic vanilla extract. It is coconut flavored and coconut textured, and its self-assurance is inspiring and delicious. Are any of these healthier than FDA-sanctioned ice cream? Have you read the data behind the landmark nutrition investigation, the China study, and its subsequent repudiations and reinterpretations? Have you read the studies tying climate change to cattle, i.e. dairy, and the ones crediting managed animal husbandry and rotational grazing with improved soil quality? Do you know whether agave is as evil as sugar? The long-term effects of organic soybean monoculturing on the ecosystem? No? Me neither. But I've read enough summaries to have concluded that it is unlikely that any version of ice cream should be eaten in large quantities, or that any version needs to be strictly avoided, unless you are also lactose intolerant or vegan or highly allergic. After we had been tasting various frozen treats for 15 minutes, it occurred to me that I should have called everything, including official ice cream, an ice. According to the authoritative pastry guide, frozen desserts, that is the true umbrella category for all frozen sweets containing water and sugar. Frozen desserts illustrates the larger ice treat kingdom via an inverted triangle with cream, milk, and sugar syrup at the corners. Cream, milk, and sugar syrup at the corners. Just as I began researching for paper to draw a square, label it ices, and write those three in corners and plant milk in the fourth, a cry rose from the end of the counter. "This is great!" shouted a Vermonter to whom I am also married. "What is this?" he demanded. It was a pint of Booza. I had been instructed by one of the Republic of Booza's founders to agitate each flavor before serving to achieve maximum chewiness. I'd forgotten, but when I tried to remove the pint of Booza from circulation to paddle them in a KitchenAid, all of the tasters formed a human blockade. I did my own sampling and found each already thick, slightly chewy, and stretchy, and potently satisfying. I cast aside my attempt to reclassify ice cream and decide to focus instead on learning to demand a creamy, refreshing summer treat in Arabic. No matter what you call it, nothing beats Booza. Well, I don't know if Jane Reitzman would have served Booza, but let's see what her life was like. Jane Reitzman first sat for Vogue in 1946, arriving at the studio where Cecil Beaton was working only to discover the exquisite actress Vivian Leigh coming out in this bower of lilac. As she recalled, She was so beautiful. So beautiful, in fact, that Jane was taken aback when she learned that she was expected to sit on the same set. "Mr. Beaton, I'm not staying here to be photographed," she declared. "Oh, yes, you are," he said. Oh, yes, you are. Jane and Beaton became friends from that day. "I loved him," she told me. "Thank God we had Cecil, or we'd have no Mrs. Reitzman," she added in her characteristically self-deprecating way. "He used to come every year and say, 'My dear, shall we do it one last time?' And I'd say, 'Yes.'" Reitzman, who died in April at the age of 99, was a legendary cultural philanthropist, a brilliant autodidact who became an expert in the French decorative arts of the 18th century and a fabled enricher of the collections of the Metropolitan Museum of Art and other notable institutions. She was also a renowned hostess, as well as a best-dressed style maker known for her unerring eye, exquisite taste, and sly wit. Born Jane Kirkman Larkin in Flint, Michigan, she had a classic American story of determined reinvention. Her father was president of the Realty Construction Company, and her whiskey-voiced mother, Aileen, known as Chuggy, who hailed from Alabama, seemed to have been as loush and untidy as her daughter was straight-laced and disciplined. Jane endured a broken childhood, and after her parents separated, she moved with her mother and three siblings to Los Angeles, where Chuggy frequented the bohemian Cafe Gala, and where her daughter added the quirky E or Y to plain Jane. In high school, Jane, J-A-Y-N-E, was known as Little Egypt for her dark bobbed hair and sophisticated use of eyeliner, and was already noted for her immaculate clothes. And by the way, this article is entitled Remembering Jane with the Y. When Jane Reitzman died in April at the age of 99, it didn't just mark an end to her taste-making talents and philanthropic prowess. It marked the end of an era. Hamish Bowles looks back at her outsize life. So to continue, after high school, she sold gloves in a department store and modeled swimsuits. Her fine-boned elegance and lipsticked glamour caught the eye of playboys and young actors and led to invitations to William Randolph Hearst's castle in San Simeon. Style icon Slim Hawks, on whom Lauren Bacall based her own on-screen persona, described Jane at the time as the only extra girl who was respectable. It was apparently at a dinner party that she caught the eye of the canny Oklahoma-born Charles B. Reitzman, the president of Standard Oil Company of Kansas, and a recently divorced father of two daughters. At the time, Reitzman was dating socialite Martha Kemp, but when he was hospitalized for lip cancer, Kemp was off gallivanting while Jane maintained a bedside vigil throughout his illness. Reitzman was evidently moved by her attentions, for when he recovered, they married. Jane was 24. As a young wife, Jane burnished her voice into a patrician, Edith Wharton-esque quaver, acquired elegant French, and set about to teach herself all there was to know about 18th century French art by listening, looking, reading, and traveling, as she put it. Reitzman was a complicated and difficult man whose first wife and both daughters effectively ended their own lives. When Nancy Mitford met him, she wrote to Evelyn Waugh that he is the 7th richest man and about the 4th nastiest. But I love him. He makes me scream with laughter. His money-making instincts, however, were remarkable. He taught himself to speak Cajun English in order to acquire vast tracts of Louisiana swamp land for oil prospecting, and ventured into Soviet Russia in 1921 for Standard Oil when other American companies did not dare. Reitzman overcame childhood illness to become a World War I aviator, a crack polo player, and an avaricious but discriminating collector. The 28-room Palm Beach mansion, which formerly showcased the legendary beauty of socialite Mona Harrison Williams, fed his social ambitions. The salt water in their pool was changed daily and permanently heated to 90 degrees, something their neighbor and friend, President John F. Kennedy, found to be a boon for his bad back. Jane was the consummate hostess, one who discreetly asked her guests about their favorite flowers, which would soon miraculously materialize in their rooms. Reitzman had determined that the only sure way to secure a place in society was through art or horses. Happily for us all, he decided on the former. As the Metropolitan Museum's former director, Philippe de Montebello, has noted, Jane's contribution to the museum was colossal. In less than a decade, she and her husband accumulated such wonders as Louis XV's red lacquer desk, Houdon's bust of Diderot, a 1680 Royal Savonnerie carpet designed by Charles Lebrun for the Grand Gallery of the Louvre, a brace of chairs signed by Georges Jacob for the Royal Palace of Fontainebleau, and Madame de Berry's rock crystal toilet bottles, which sat on Jane's dressing table. The Reitmans also owned Vermeer's Study of a Young Woman and Georges de La Tour's magisterial The Penitent Magdalene, both now at the Metropolitan Museum. There were 4 Canalettos and El Greco and works by Audry, Renoir, and Monet. As the decorator Henri Samuel of the great French House of Janssen worked on the decor of the Palm Beach House, the previous interior by Siri Mom was transformed with original Parquet de Versailles flooring and 18th century paneling installed in the rooms into a Louis XVI mansion, framing views of palm trees and tropical flora. Later, Vincent Fourcade added an almost orientalist layer of splendor to the scheme with Indian furniture, ottomans, paisley upholstery fabrics, and 17th century Persian carpet underfoot. Having grown up in a disordered household, Jane ran hers with a fastidious rigor. Her antebellum standards were giddyingly high, and she expected her intimate circle of friends to live up to them. She once started a grand dinner 10 minutes before the illustrious, though faintly tardy, guest of honor arrived. But although formidable she was kind and thoughtful, and could be playfully conspirational and extremely droll. Her eyes, her eye, had seen a century's worth of roiling change, which she navigated with consummate elegance, style, and curiosity. That era has ended. All right. And then finally, shadow play. Eyeshadow doesn't express us, it transforms us. Back in 1998, I was 15 years old and perpetually afraid to speak. I hated being tall because I hated being looked at. I never wanted to call attention to my face because I didn't believe I was beautiful enough to deserve anyone's gaze. It was easy to dismiss makeup as superficial. Lipstick, blush, mascara. These were for the popular girls, the ones who never seemed to have trouble figuring out what to say. But eyeshadow was mine. Leaning in close to the bathroom mirror before semi-formal dances, brushing post-apocalyptic shades from Urban Decay across my lids, I found a way to speak loudly, to trade my inside voice for an outside voice at last. This season's embrace of these shimmering and matte pigments in all of their most vibrant hues suggests that same claiming of agency. From the painterly sizzle of turquoise and melon at Marni to the retro powdery blue at Lou Dallas and Miriam Nasser Zadek, each gesture offers a portal to another possible self in another possible world. Laid out as a feverish rainbow across my glass coffee table, these vivid powders reveal eyeshadow's singular imperative. It doesn't accentuate the natural colors of our bodies, the way lipstick draws on the red of our lips or mascara deepens the black of our lashes. It summons what the body isn't. A spaceship, a galaxy, an upholstered Victorian bed. The logic of eyeshadow is metaphoric, not metonymic or nimic. It doesn't just bring our faces to the world, it brings the world to our faces. Well, we have run out of time for today's episode of Teen Magazines. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Monica Gall. You have been listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, TriangleRadioReadingService.org. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. I hope you make it a great week. Next week will be August. Enjoy your summer. Enjoy some of that fabulous, ice cream. Whatever kind you like.